There is a great sermon in there, I promise you. But anyway, I wasn't that flummoxed by the sermon. I'm not assuming everyone does know me. I'm the district minister for this area. So with another colleague, I share Greenwich, Bexley and Dartford, looking after the Baptist churches in the area. And until Wednesday just gone, I was the managing chaplain of HMP Thameside, which is London's newest prison, the biggest prison on our patch now. But I stepped away from that role on Wednesday without a post to go to. Very exciting times, I think. Obviously, the children won't eat, but we'll wait and see what God's doing. And if the mic really plays up, I'll just go into non-microphone, but I realise that the loop does bless us. In January, David said to me, Andrew, there's a really, really difficult subject. I think it will come better from you because it's on church discipline. So I ended up preaching in January. I know why David's asked me to preach on this one, which is to do with how we speak. Because if there's one person who has been in the leadership team here who would naturally get it wrong regularly, it would be me. Okay, I love talking. I come from a family of talkers. If you ever meet my dad, although he's getting more frail, my dad has still got something to talk about. And words are amazing and words are lovely, but shall I step back this way? Perhaps but words are also things where we can get it wrong. We live in an adversarial world. We live in a world that shapes you against other people. I'll give you an example. We might have mixed views of our parliament, but our parliament is admired the world over still. And yet it's adversarial. You have a party in power and you have a party not in power. And that could be different arrangements, but it's adversarial. In fact, I don't know if you know anything about the Houses of Parliament. There are two red lines which are two sword lengths apart so that when they're arguing, they can't actually manage to stab anybody whilst they're talking through things. I love the idea. I think I'd love to see Jeremy Corbyn and Theresa May go at it. Our courtrooms, again, British legal system's not perfect. You know, I've worked for 5.5 years within the prison service. It's not perfect, but it is admired the world over. If you're treated unfairly in this country, it's a darn sight better than being treated unfairly in a lot of other countries. Okay? And yet it's adversarial. You go to court, and it's the Crown's responsibility to prove that you are guilty. And it is your brief's responsibility to show that you're not. It's adversarial. If you go for a job, we'd love to believe that they gather together all the people with all the right attributes and they discern who's right. But actually, you're down to the last two and they either want you or they don't. I've been in that place quite a few times. It's actually quite a nice place to be. It's quite liberating because if they don't want you and they want the other person, there's nothing you can do about it. But it's actually quite adversarial. And the X Factor and The Voice and pitch battle, you know, I know they're all packaged. I know we're all opting into being entertained, but it's actually us versus them. We're in this adversarial world that where people and issues bump heads. But the counterpoint for us as followers of Jesus is that there is a real crux, a real bite point where God's values come a counterpoint to the world's powers and principalities. That the cross is actually the counterpoint to death itself. And then there's a crown for you and me of being humble under God's power. Not building a power base. So we've got one of the Proverbs today, but as is God's way, you find yourself being taken off in a very slightly different direction. So I hope it does still hang around this idea of how we speak into situations. But actually, Tim and I are going to finish my preach with a song. Now you'll want to join in. Will you give us at least the first verse? Because we may well pull it about a little bit. But you'll want to join. You'll see when we get it. I need a bleeper, don't I? Thank you. So I want to look at confrontation. Not necessarily aggression, but actually how do we deal with situations where we are confronted with something? How do we deal with things where we think, do you know what, that's not right. That's not good. What shall I do about it? I grew up at Queen Street in North Heath. The family have always been, the Baptist mafia of the Singleton family, have always been in local churches. But there was a dynamic in the 60s and the 70s and maybe even into the 80s where Baptist churches, they were all very pleasant. You described someone as being pleasant the other day, and I said to Nadine, please never, ever describe me as being pleasant. It sounds horrible. But there was this, you know, this cuddly sort of, you know, oh yes, lovely. Bless you. Which I get, because some people know no love in their lives. And this is family, and we want to feel safe. But maybe as we went 80s into 90s into the last 15 or so years, the Baptist churches in Britain are being challenged to be prepared to stand up and speak out, to take the stand on issues. I'll give you an example. Tim Fallon, whether you agree with the Lib Dems' point of view or not, Tim Fallon got to a point where he realised he needed to speak out. And he got shed loads of rubbish thrown at him. And do you know what? He stood by it. I heard him speak a second time on the television, and I thought he was so good, where he said, please remember, I'm a political leader, not a religious leader. I have my faith, and that is what I shape. And he was being asked, how can he be in a Lib Dem party, which is actually quite a broad party and quite an accepting party? I thought he answered really well. Speaking out into situations. But unfortunately, so often it is that those situations are hard work. So often it's that the people on the other side have got the evil one's power to stir things up. And we would love to speak the words of God into a situation, but actually what we do is we reel our neck in and we don't do anything at all. So let's have a little bit of a look. This is Proverbs 15, verse 1. A soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. For any of you in the last 21 years who've got annoyed with me, it's probably because of what came out of my mouth. And it stirs up something in you. Think, oh, for goodness sake, Andrew. Ugh. I think that about myself as well. But then, a gentle answer. The actual word is tender or meek. Meek. I don't know if you know the word meek is a horse under bridle. Okay? It's not a sleepy bunny rabbit on your lap. It's power subjugated by God having control. A tender word, a soft answer, turns away wrath. Notice it doesn't say a soft answer means we can all be peaceful and step away from the situation. It's an active thing. It's aiming to turn something around when it's difficult. I had a very interesting last week at work. On the Monday, which was really my last full day of work, I had a full-blown inspection, 25 greens across the board. Sorry, Jonathan, but Belmarsh's chaplaincy team can't deliver that. I think they're green, but there you go. But you're under the spotlight. And some of them you think, hang on, this isn't right, this isn't good, this isn't fair. And you have to work that through with integrity. And then Tuesday, I was in work and it was handover and meetings and whatever. And inside a prison, you have panic buttons, big green buttons on the wall, okay, in different places. So, for example, in the main chaplaincy office, there's one by the door. As you step out into the corridor, there's another one on the wall. 5.5 years, I've never even touched one, okay. And my line manager had sort of said to me, look, do you want to get going a bit early? I thought I was going to go home about 2:30. Okay, so that's what. 2 o'clock, a bloke went for me. Okay. Mark's not here today. Only a couple of people really get this. Jonathan, he was a Mormon and he wanted his hot chocolate, all right? There's a whole sermon in there somewhere, don't worry. Makes no sense, but he went for me. He said, you know, excuse me, managing chaplain, I'd love a chat with you about the situation that I currently... And he was 6'2"-ish. So I talked with him. And in fact, Peter made the comment that he heard me go into teacher mode with how I was speaking to him. Slightly slower, factual, saying what I expected, but he carried on. So I stepped back. You'll be pleased to know, Jonathan, I stepped back. I then stepped into a position where you think someone's going to go for you. But then I thought, you know what? I'm going to try a slightly different tack. So I said to this guy, look, I would love to work with you and resolve this. But at the moment, I don't think we can because you're so aggressive. And he went, ew. So I leant on the wall. and the grab team appeared and we had a conversation with this gentleman on his way back to his cell. But you might not find yourself in confrontational mode, but we can sit and see the news and go, do you know what? That's just not right. And maybe as a fellowship, corporately, we have to step up sometimes and we have to speak a tender answer, a God-centered answer or word into a situation which otherwise just has anger and wrath. A few little points just to draw out about how we function in the world. Aggression breeds aggression. If someone's having a go at you, it is quite normal that we then feel we need to be, at the very least, defensive. But the evil one can get in with us and stir up in ourselves how we want to deal with that person who's just pushed in the line to get on the 422 bus when I have been standing there waiting really nicely. We see tribalism across the world. Most of the flashpoints in the world have got tribalism built into them. Most of the crime flashpoints across London have got tribalism in them. You might have heard of, you know, the phrase an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. It comes up in a moment, actually. Where people view that if something wrong has been done, they've got to do something. And unfortunately, it always takes them in that harsh, violent style. And we become less of ourselves as followers of Jesus. And there's also a vendetta around. You might not think it. You might think it's more to do with Italian gangsters. A lot of the work going on in prisons is actually challenging vendetta culture, where something has gone wrong and bad and serious. So somebody else has got to do something, and somebody else has got to do something. And it never, ever goes away. That's the problem. The evil one knows how you and I tick as humans and can so easily make us bitter and twisted over something. And he gets a foothold when actually it's the God who went to the cross who should actually be setting the tone for you and for me. However, There's also a danger that there seems like some shame in not responding. If someone is being aggressive, if someone is being unjust, and we step up and we speak out metaphorically or actually, then we put ourselves in a position where actually society very quickly can throw shame at us. So again, Tim Fallon, he was basically shamed by the press for saying, do you know what, this is what I believe. Interestingly, I think it's what David Cameron believes as well, but he pushed through a law on a PC line. But very often as Christians, we can worry about the shame that might come on us, the focus that's all negative. Can I encourage you? Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. We're following a God who, through Jesus Christ, went to the cross. The shame that he knew for you and for me. There's another issue, really. Can I encourage you that being a peacemaker is not passivity. It is not choosing to do nothing. We're encouraged to be peacemakers. We're encouraged to be peacemakers, to bring God's word into situations. And actually opting to do nothing isn't doing that. We are challenged to bring the good news of Jesus into people's lives, into situations, into our society, onto the streets of Belvedere. That will mean we have to stand up, speak out, step out. It's not, let's go into a holy huddle because there's nothing else we can do. Sometimes prayer is the only thing we can do, but really be careful not to opt for pure passivity. Matthew 5 says, you have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist an evildoer. Do not resist an evildoer. But if anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn the other also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your coat, give them their cloak. Give them your cloak as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go also the second mile. How can we speak into a situation where there might be suffering, pain, shame, rejection, death, all those negative things in life? And you can see those there as well, other negative things. How can we turn this around with the gospel of Jesus Christ that we know for ourselves? I don't know if you know about these examples. In the Old Testament, an eye for an eye was a law that said only an eye for an eye. So if someone, you know, had taken an eye, the just punishment wasn't taking an eye and a hand. Okay, now, it might sound really horrible, but it was a limit. It was bringing God's righteousness and justice into what could have just spiraled forever. I can picture a Monty Python thing where the guy has his limbs chopped off bit by bit and he's still inviting a fight. But there we are. If anyone wants to sue you and take your coat, now, the Jewish people have been under Assyrian rule, they've been under Greek rule, they've been under Roman rule. And really, the Romans could say, oh, I like your coat, give it here. Okay? Give it here. And this says, if someone tries to sue you for your coat, offer them your cloak as well. Oh, hang on a minute. They suddenly become beholden to you. You suddenly gain back the moral high ground and a little bit of power in that situation. A Roman could see somebody and say, here, I've got all this stuff. Here, you Jewish man, you can carry this for a mile. A mile was basically viewed as the space of your village or your town where you would move around. A Roman could force you to carry his load for you. But the Roman army had a limit in place, that it was unjust to make someone go any further than that. No, let me go 2 miles. come with me, let's go 2 miles with this. Why? Oh, hang on a minute, then the Roman soldier would be in debt to you. Slightly in these illustrations, Jesus is saying, find the right, the just, moral high ground that has integrity, that makes someone deal with you in the right way. I don't know whether the illustration to do with the right cheek and the left cheek's correct, but I did hear someone a couple of years ago preach where if you want to be very dismissive, you would backhand someone. All right? But, can I borrow you, Spiro? Purely for the sake of biblical integrity. So, yeah, if you wanted to be dismissive, you would backhand someone, wouldn't you? It's that sort of movement. But in a family, an open-handed movement is very different. I don't quite... Thank you. I'm not really going to thump you yet. I don't know if that illustration's correct, but that idea of someone being unjustly treated and someone having the integrity to say, do you want to hit me a second time? It's interesting, it takes the dynamic out of a situation straight away. It gives a little bit of the authority back to the person who is under the cosh, under the pressure. Let's bear in mind that Christ himself lived sacrificially. Think about the situation where he was with the Samaritan woman, the woman caught in adultery, the man with demons, the man with leprosy. At every situation there, he put himself as nothing to the people around him. He said, there is another way to deal with it. Not, I'm not going to do anything. There is another way that God can turn this situation around. But people say, but I can imagine Jesus' family saying, come away from him, he's got leprosy. I can see the authorities around him, perhaps the Pharisees and Sadducees, seeing the man with demons and saying, don't go anywhere near him, he's beyond the pale. He lives in a cave outside of the town because that's the only safe place we can stay holy. I can see people muttering when he stops to talk to a Samaritan woman, someone from somewhere else who's got it wrong. I can see his disciples saying, are you sure about this? When he's dealing with a woman clearly caught in adultery where there's a set law to deal with this. And he says, do you know what? Let me humble myself sacrificially because I want to bring God's word into this situation. I want to turn it around. God lived as Christ sacrificially. He left his glory for you and for me. He wanted to save the lost, the confused, the messed up. He left his glory for me, for you and for me. I don't know if you've ever thought of yourself as the lost. You probably think of yourself as the found. I'm in church. I've been found. We're the lost that he came for. We were the ones that he would risk everything for. Isn't that bringing a gentle word into what otherwise would be an aggressive world? He left his glory. And for us, we've got the image of the cross. An emblem of what God would actually give into a situation. But of course, it actually meant a false trial, wrong accusations, being stripped, being whipped, being walked through the city probably nearly naked, being hung naked. Being abused, spat on, probably, it doesn't say, but the boot being put in. Being nailed to a cross, even though that wasn't necessary. It was just a bit of fun. All of that. And in that, then people suddenly went, oh, maybe this isn't the promised one. So actually, God was prepared to risk people losing sight of the very person he'd sent. He was prepared to lose all of that to bring a tender word, a gentle word, a humble word, a sacrificial statement into an aggressive world at the cross. What God would do for you and for me. We're also challenged to witness to other people. Speech shapes how people see us. I love talking. Too much, I know. But if you are a talker, it's really good sometimes to stop and double check. And if you've got someone who loves you dearly and you trust, sometimes they may well tell you when to shut up. They might be wrong, of course, but we do need to be careful because people shape how they receive us by what we say and how we say it. And if we're people who will quickly let our mouths run away with, perhaps we have to stop and go, okay, what will God say into this situation? I've supported a couple of people going up to give evidence in court in the last year. I've done it three times, I think. And every time I go as the head of staff care, or I did, and I would sit with them and say, okay, the moment you're asked a question, take a breath. Then think, what was the question? And then answer the question. And every time I've been in a courtroom where it's gone out of control, and you can usually spot it because the lawyer on the prison's behalf is going, take a note. Is when people start letting their voices go. We need to be careful of what comes out of our mouths. I'm not saying don't witness to people. I'm not saying don't be a chatty person if you're a chatty person. But our witness to those who don't know Jesus is shaped by our speech. And they see us. They listen to, you know, you can talk the talk, but can you walk the walk? But they actually listen to the talk. And they make up their mind about the walk quite quickly. So as we walk as disciples of Jesus, perhaps we've got to go, okay, I need to walk humbly and therefore learn to talk humbly too. But it's Luke 18. The Pharisee standing by himself was praying thus, God, I thank you that I am not... I'll put my church voice on. God, I thank you that I am not like those other people. Thieves, rogues, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week, I give a tenth of all my income, but the tax collector, standing far off, would not even look up to heaven. But he was beating his breast and saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. I tell you, this man went down to his home justified rather than the other. For all who exalt themselves will be humbled, and all who humble themselves will be exalted. Speech is very powerful, but Christ brings an upside down kingdom. It completely turns what we view as important on its head. Maximilian Kolbe, you might have known. Who knows who Maximilian Kolbe is? Oh, that's interesting. Maximilian Kolbe is viewed as the patron saint of prisons. He was a Roman Catholic priest in Poland, an outspoken man and writer. He wrote about mission in the 1930s, and he was arrested by the German Nazis and sent to a concentration camp, I think to Auschwitz. And Maximilian Kolbe decided that in that camp he would still stand up and speak out when things were wrong and unjust. And so he became the focus of the guard, at the very least giving them a quick thumping. He was regularly in trouble. Unfortunately, he spoke out and everyone heard and thought, yeah, you're right. One day, some prisoners had tried to escape and the guards, the authorities decided that they would execute 10 prisoners, and they randomly chose 10 prisoners to be killed. And there was a young guy in the lineup, and Maximilian Kolbe stepped forward and said, can I take his place? He is a young man with a young family. Can I take his place? Now, I don't know whether the Nazi authorities thought this is good, we're going to get rid of him at last. And he's made the choice himself, but he stepped forward and he took the young man's place. They locked these guys up there. Their means of execution was to lock them in a room and leave them to starve. And each day, the authorities came to the cell to find that another guy had died. And Maximilian Kolbe was in the middle of the cell on his knees in prayer. Day after day after day after day. Until day 10, when Kolbe, and I think that was in August actually, of 44, when Kolbe, they found that he was the only one left alive. And they decided by an injection of carbolic acid to kill Kolbe. In 1984, the Catholic Church, and I know this isn't our tradition, the Catholic Church in 84 decided to make him a saint. And the young man who had been saved was one of the principal guests there with his family. Why? Because Kolbe was prepared to say, I live in Christ's kingdom, and it's an upside-down one from what the world looks like. I'm prepared to stand up and to speak out, to bring God's message through Jesus Christ into a situation. The cross itself is actually where death is defeated. The cross seems a tender, humble, nothingy, passive option of someone being executed, but actually it's where God defeats death itself. He defeats aggression. So actually we should be a little bit more comfortable to speak up and speak God's peace into situations because of Christ's upside down kingdom. We're called maybe to bear shame in the eyes of others. We're called to challenge society's norms when they say, oh no, that's the way it's got to be. That's what we're going to do. We're called to be sacrificial. Remember the proverb about a tender word to turn wrath. We are actually called to do something, but it may well be sacrificial. And why? Because we've got a challenge to bring the gospel of Jesus to a world that actually needs peace. It needs tenderness and gentleness. It needs love and calm. We need to live out our lives witnessing that the cross itself wasn't an aggressive world winning over a passive person prepared to be killed. But actually, the cross itself is where God brings glory to other people, and that's ourselves. It's our ultimate glory where we meet Christ in the cross itself. Come on, Tim. Can you give me a G? That's the one. On a hill far away stood an old rugged cross, the emblem of suffering and shame. But I love that old cross where the dearest and best for a world of lost sinners was slain. So I'll cherish the old rugged cross till my trophies at last I lay down. I will cling to the old rugged cross and exchange it someday for a crown. Oh, that old rugged cross, so despised by the world, has a wondrous attraction for me. For the dear Lamb of God left His glory above to bear it to dark Calvary. So I'll cherish the old rugged cross till my trophies at last I lay down. And I will cling to the old rugged cross and exchange it someday for a crown. To the old rugged cross, stained with blood so divine, a wondrous beauty I see. For 'twas on that old cross Jesus suffered and died to pardon and sanctify me. Shall we stand? So I'll cherish the old rugged cross until my trophies at last I lay down. And I will cling to the old rugged cross and exchange it someday for a crown. And to the old rugged cross I will ever be true, its shame and reproach gladly bear. And then it called me someday to my home far away, where His glory the old rugged cross till my trophies at last I lay down. I will cling to the old rugged cross and exchange it someday for a crown. So I'll cherish the old rugged cross till my trophies at last I lay down. I will cling to the old rugged cross and exchange it someday for a crown. Lord, as we continue in worship, help us to see that there is nothing more powerful than being at the foot of the cross. There is nothing more powerful when we were dealing with aggression and spite and venom and pain. There is nothing more powerful than cherishing and clinging to the cross of Jesus Christ. Help us to speak that good news into other people's lives. Help us to be ready to stop, to hold back our own words and wait for God to speak into situations. Help us to lay our own trophies aside, the own stuff of power-based building, where we're looking for progression and status. Lord, help us to come before You, the God who would risk everything to save me, the lost. Amen. Worship group, can I hand back over to you? Bless you.